Today we are going to look at Jeff Bezos's letters to shareholders. It's very interesting. It seems pretty unrelated to products podcast, but I also believe there is a ton of great lessons here for us product builders. Starting in 2023, letter to shareholders. A good compass is to pick real customer problems you're trying to solve. This is a quote in the letter. Jeff is talking about how to evaluate whether you're creating the right products, right functionality, right features, and so on. I read the quote again. A good compass is to pick real customer problems you're trying to solve. A lot of the times, product builders get into this imaginative world, which is important. You need to be imagining the worlds that could be and creating things, but it must, in some way or the other, tie back to customer problems or customer needs. Otherwise, you end up creating something that nobody wants. There are a few aspects that Jeff calls out in the letter to the shareholders, 2023 letter. Price. Being sharp on price is always important. After 30 years in business, they're still very laser focused on customer value and offering wide selection and sharp prices. Particularly given the economy and customers being very careful about how they spend their money, price becomes extremely important. Second one, speed. Amazon delivered at the fastest speeds ever to Prime members. 7+ billion items, that's a B, billion with a B, items arriving same day or next day. By re-architecting the network to store items closer to customers, increased the number of items delivered same day or overnight by 70%. This is another one of those things that are very unique to Jeff Bezos's letters to shareholders. It's not all fluff and hype. Everything he writes is backed by percentages and numbers and data and anecdotes. As we get items to customers this fast, customers choose Amazon to fulfill their shopping needs more frequently. And we can see the results in how fast our everyday essentials business is growing, 20% year over year. Third piece he talks about in this letter is cost. Our regionalization efforts trimmed transportation distances, helping lower our cost to serve. Reduced cost to serve by 45 cents per unit year over year. Decreased cost to serve allows us to invest in speed improvements and afford adding more selection at lower average selling price. More selection at lower prices puts us in consideration for more purchases. This is again part of the Amazon famous Amazon flywheel. He also talks about Amazon ads. Growing at 24% year over year from $38 billion to $47 billion, especially the sponsored ads. AWS customers are cautious about IT spending. Amazon leveraged price performant AWS capabilities like Graviton chips instead of Intel x86 chips. 40% better price to performance ratio with these chips. S3 intelligent storing that uses AI to store less frequently used objects in less expensive storage layers, and savings plans which give customers lower prices for longer term commitment. By end of 2023, we are seeing cost optimization attenuating, new deals accelerating, renewing at larger commitments over longer periods, and migrations are growing again. Past year, we announced next generation CPU chips, Graviton 4, which provides 30% better compute performance, I believe, and 75% more memory bandwidth than Graviton 3. We announced Trainium 2 chips, which will deliver 4 times faster machine learning training in GenAI applications, and 3 times more memory capacity than Trainium 1. We invented and delivered a new service called Amazon Bedrock that lets companies leverage existing foundation models to build GenAI applications. And we launched most capable coding assistant, Amazon Q. We have increasing conviction that Prime Video can be large and profitable business on its own. We hit a major milestone in our journey to commercialize Project Kuiper. Kuiper is Low Earth Orbit Satellite Initiative that aims to provide broadband to the 400 to 500 million households who don't have it today. I just recalled that I made a small mistake in the beginning of the show. This particular letter is actually not written by Jeff Bezos, but this is 2023. So it's Andy Jassy, who was the CEO at the time and who is still the CEO of Amazon. As I was going through my notes on this letter, I think there were some aspects that somewhat led me to recall that this is actually Andy Jassy talking, not Jeff Bezos. We characterize builders as people who like to invent. They like to dissect a customer experience, assess what's wrong with it, and reinvent it. Those are builders. I mean, we all are product builders. Something for us to take away. We like to invent. We like to dissect a customer experience and see what is wrong with it and how we can reinvent to make that customer experience better. Builders tend not to be satisfied until the customer experience is perfect. This doesn't hinder them from delivering improvements along the way, but it drives them to keep tinkering and iterating continually. While unafraid to invent from scratch, they have no hesitation about using high-quality, scalable, cost-effective components from others. What matters to builders is having the right tools to keep rapidly improving customer experiences. We have increasing conviction that Prime Video can be large and profitable business on its own. We hit a major milestone in our journey to commercialize Project Kuiper. Kuiper is a low Earth orbit satellite initiative that aims to provide broadband to the 400 to 500 million households who don't have broadband today. The best way we know how to do better customer experiences, how to invent better customer experiences, is by building what we call primitive services. Primitives are the raw parts or the most foundational level building blocks for software developers. They are indivisible. If they can be functionally split into two, they must be. And they do one thing really well. This is a very interesting idea. Primitives not only applies to Amazon Web Services or the API first approach that Amazon takes within the company. But the focus on one thing and making the primitive so indivisible is extremely important, even for startups or founders who are trying to launch 0 to 1 products. If you can really, really niche down on the segment, the ideal customer profile, and the functionality you're going to build for them, and then just completely dedicate yourself to building that one thing really, really well, I think that is a primitive, and then you repeat that for other primitives. I think you have a successful product and successful business. These primitives are meant to be used together rather than as solutions in and out of themselves. And we'll build them for maximum developer flexibility. We won't put a bunch of constraints on primitives to guard against developers hurting themselves. This is another interesting aspect of how Amazon thinks about primitives or building blocks. Like a lot of the times I've seen in product teams, you start to sort of devise these plans and convoluted limits and constraints around the product functionality to make sure that your users don't hurt themselves. That to me somehow seems counterintuitive. You're almost like undermining your users, and you think your users are not that smart. I feel that there is a problem there. I mean, yeah, there may be a few who might hurt themselves, but just because of that, you shouldn't create these artificial constraints in the product. So going back to what Andy Jassy is talking about, we won't put a bunch of constraints on primitives to guard against developers hurting themselves. Instead, we'll optimize for developer freedom and innovation. Primitives done well rapidly accelerate builders' ability to innovate. Buy with Prime, fulfillment by Amazon, supply chain by Amazon are a few examples of products or services built with primitives. AI, SageMaker, which is the bottom layer of the AI stack that Amazon Bedrock has developed, is to build and train foundational models. Bedrock as the middle layer to use existing foundation models, and then on the top layer is the AI applications like Rufus, Alexa, Amazon Q. Recently, I was asked a provocative question: how does Amazon remain resilient? While simple in its wording, it's profound because it gets to the heart of our success to date, as well as for the future. The answer lies in our discipline around deeply held principles. One, hiring builders who are motivated to continually improve and expand what is possible. I think this is extremely important for product teams. Like when I hire or interview people for product management roles or product builder opportunities within my team, I really am very curious about what have they built. Like to be a product manager or a successful product manager or builder or product leader, I think it's very fundamental that you've built something. It doesn't have to be software, it doesn't have to be AI, it can be just building stuff with your hands, but you have to build. Like you've got to build stuff. If you're not motivated to improve on an existing experience, or if you're not motivated to just build stuff and expand on what is possible, then I personally don't believe you can be a good product leader. Number two, solving real customer challenges. Rather than what we think may be interesting technology, this is a very big problem in many organizations where teams of very smart engineers and product managers get caught up in what is possibly, a solution built for a problem that doesn't exist, because you're working inside out as opposed to working backwards from the customer. So you're thinking, oh, there's this new cool technology. How do we use that technology? How do we make something cool? I think it almost invariably never results in a successful product or a business. Number three, building in primitives so that we can innovate and experiment at the highest rate. I think when you have these primitives or building blocks, like Lego blocks, if you will, and they all have certain ways to fit with each other. So if you like, imagine you're building a big castle or a theme park with Lego blocks. Each of these teams can take these Lego blocks and build stuff at very rapid pace. And then you can all come together and voila, you have the theme park or the big building or whatever that you're trying to build. And that's only possible because of the building blocks, the primitives. Number four, not wasting time trying to fight gravity. Spoiler alert, you always lose. When we discover technology that enables better customer experiences, we embrace it. I think this is very important. Like you embrace the technology, but you don't embrace it just for the sake of embracing new technology. But you embrace the technology to build better customer experiences. I think that is the underlying point to make note of. And the last one, number five, accepting and learning from failed experiments. Actually, becoming more energized to try again with new knowledge to employ. I think this is a very hard one for a lot of teams. When you try something and you fail, it's very hard to say it's a failed experiment, we learned something, let's become more energized and try again. I've been at fault for this as well. Trying something did not work. Instead of having the grit and pushing through and trying maybe different approaches, as long as you have the vision for the product and what you want to accomplish in this world, the details can be changed. But if the vision itself, you're not convinced about it after running a few experiments, then I think it's okay probably to give up on that because you don't believe in the vision anymore. But if you believe in the vision, however crazy it may be, and you have the conviction, then failed experiments only must energize us to do more and more faster and learn from the past experiences. Shareholder letter from 2022. Invention is often messy. It wanders and meanders and marinates. This letter is actually, I'm pretty sure it was by Jeff Bezos. We had to double down on the fulfillment center footprint that we'd built over the prior 25 years and substantially accelerate building last mile transportation network that is now the size of UPS in the span of 2 years. This was no easy feat. There was a lot of optimization needed to yield the intended productivity. Over the last several months, we have scrutinized every process path in our fulfillment centers and transportation network and redesigned scores of processes and mechanisms, resulting in steady productivity gains and cost reductions. When we look at new investment opportunities, we ask ourselves a few questions. One, if we were successful, could it be big and have a reasonable return on invested capital? I think an interesting and important question for product builders and founders to ask. If we were truly successful at what we want to accomplish in this world and the vision that we have in our mind actually plays out the way you imagine, then could this be a big business? Could it be really big? Could it have the big impact that you want to have? And can it have a reasonable return on invested capital? If the answer to all of this is yes, 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 I think that's one question, very important question that you've answered. Great. Number two, is the opportunity being well served today? So this is about competitive landscape. What are the alternative solutions that already exist in the market? And are they being well served by these existing solutions? If not, what are the gaps? I think that is important to assess before blindly jumping into building a product, and learn from people who have come before you. Number three, do we have a differentiated approach? I think, like we talked about in the previous episode, number three, on Amazon.com, I think one of the key things is, are we building a me too product, or are we differentiating? Like, if you're contrarian and right, then you will have the most potential for success. But if you're doing a me too product and you don't have any particular differentiation, I think it's fine, but you will basically fall into this other quadrant in the 2x2 matrix we talked about, which is you're kind of not contrarian, you're just doing a me too kind of product with small improvements. But you're right, because the product, let's say the competitive solutions are doing pretty well in the market, then you can actually be pretty decently successful. I mean, there are plenty of examples of that in the market today. You have Instagram, you have TikTok, you have Facebook for content, video content, you have YouTube. For messaging, you have WhatsApp, Telegram, Messenger, and so on and so forth, many others. For social media, messaging kind of thing, you have Twitter, you have Threads, you have Blue Sky. I mean, the list goes on and on. A lot of them are, in some small ways, differentiating from each other. But the core product, I think, is still the same. But they're all decently successful. So a differentiated approach is absolutely not a must for you to be moderately successful at something. But if you truly want to do something extraordinary, I think a yes on this question of do we differentiate ourselves in the approach we take is very important. And number four is, do we have the competence in this area that we are trying to invest in? And if not, can we acquire it quickly? I think Jensen Wong from NVIDIA says it really well, very crisply, that he's not interested in doing something if somebody else can do it. It's as simple as that. It feels like crazy to think about it that way. Like, if you don't have the competence in that area, but somebody else actually can do this job better than you, I think you have no business to be doing that. You should only get into this business or this product only because you have something that you think you have an edge, you have something better to offer to customers. And if we like the answers to these questions, then we'll invest. This process has led to some expansions that seem straightforward, and others that some folks might not have initially guessed. Amazon Fresh is their investment bet in the $800 billion groceries market. And Amazon Business, launched in 2015, today drives about $35 billion in annualized gross sales. I mean, this is, again, talking in terms of 2022. Now we're in 2025. With 6 million customers, Amazon Business does $35 billion in annualized gross sales with 6 million customers. Amazon Healthcare and Amazon Cuber are potential analogs where we are making investments that are further from our core businesses. Amazon Pharmacy is a full-service online pharmacy. Amazon Care, One Medical, which they acquired, is primary care. Cuber provides broadband connectivity to 400 million people who currently do not have broadband at 400 megabits per second. And Prime Air is another investment which will deliver items faster and at a lower cost using drones. So these are all different investments they've made. Amazon Fresh, Amazon Business, Amazon Healthcare, Amazon Cuber, Amazon Pharmacy, and Prime Air. And all of these sort of follow these fundamental investment questions that we just went over. Is this, if we were successful, could this be big? Will we be able to make a reasonable return on invested capital? Is the opportunity well served by somebody else today? Do we have a differentiated approach? And do we have the competence in this area? Shareholder letters 2021. People often assume that the game-changing inventions they admire just pop out of somebody's head. A light bulb goes off, a team executes to that idea, and presto, you have a new invention that's a breakaway success for a long time. That's rarely, if ever, how it happens. I think, just a side note, I think we're kind of all spoiled by the Eureka moment that we all talk about. Like, I had this Eureka moment, and then boom. I'm recalling, for example, Instagram founder Kevin Systrom. I think he talks about how he was walking on the beach with his girlfriend, and she said she's not able to post photos online because she's embarrassed by the quality of the photos. And he's like, oh my God, that's a problem I can solve. Why don't I make the photos better so I can publish them? So they created all these filters and things like that. That almost sounds like a Eureka moment, and maybe it is, and that's a brilliant idea, a simple idea. But I think what Jeff is calling out here is that idea in itself isn't going to make any difference. Like, hundreds and thousands of people have similar ideas every day. But what actually is needed is, the conviction to follow through and the belief in yourself and your abilities to execute on this, and then working hard to make it happen and going through lots of ups and downs in the journey to make the idea become true in the world. You want to see it so desperately that you will do whatever it takes to make it happen. I think those are all things that take time. So that's rarely, if ever, how it happens, is what he's talking about, like these Eureka moments converted into overnight product successes. One of the lesser known facts about innovative companies like Amazon is that they are relentlessly debating, redefining, tinkering, iterating, and experimenting to take the seed of a big idea and make it into something that resonates with customers and meaningfully changes their customer experience over a long period of time. Again, this is Jeff Bezos talking. Let me give you some Amazon examples. Our fulfillment network. Going back to the pandemic, this is COVID, coronavirus pandemic in 2020. There is no way we could have started working on our fulfillment network in March of 2020 and satisfied anything close to what our customers needed. We had been innovating in our fulfillment network for 20 years. Constantly trying to shorten the time to get items to customers. In the early 2000s, it took us an average of 18 hours to get an item through our fulfillment centers and on the right truck for shipment. Now it takes us 2 hours. To deliver a reliably and cost effectively as we desire, and to serve Amazon Prime expecting shipments in a couple of days, Amazon Prime members expecting shipments in a couple of days, we spent years building out an expensive set of fulfillment centers, a substantial logistics and transportation capability, and reconfigured how we did virtually everything in our facilities. I mean, this is where I feel like people say, you got to be lucky, you have to time it properly, all of that. I think those are all important, but you can't time things. Plan luck, right? So people do say when opportunity meets preparation, that's luck. And I kind of believe that. I think you're working towards something, you don't necessarily see the results of it immediately, but you're constantly trying to make the customer experience better, and in the process, you're building a lot of new things, innovating, and at some time, your preparation meets an opportunity, and you're way ahead of everybody else already. You don't have to start inventing then. For perspective, in 2004, we had 7 fulfillment centers in the US and 4 in other parts of the world. And we had not yet added delivery stations, which connect our fulfillment and sortation centers to the last mile delivery vans you see driving around your neighborhood. Fast forward to the end of 2021, we had 253 fulfillment centers. That is going from 7 to 253, 100 sortation centers, and 467 delivery stations across North America, with an additional 157 fulfillment centers, 58 sortation centers, and 588 delivery stations across the globe. Our delivery network grew to more than 260,000 drivers worldwide. And our Amazon Air cargo fleet has more than 100 aircrafts. This has represented a capital investment of over $100 billion and countless iterations and small process improvements by over a million Amazonians in the last decade and a half. Ironically, just before COVID started, we had made the decision to invest billions of incremental dollars over several years to deliver an increasing number of prime shipments in one day. This initiative was slowed by the challenges of the pandemic, but we have since resumed our focus here. Delivering a substantial amount of shipments in one day is hard, especially across the millions of items that we offer, and initially expensive as we build out the infrastructure to scale this efficiently. But we believe our over 200 million Prime customers, who will tell you very clearly that faster is almost always better, will love this. So this capability to ship millions of items within a couple of days, and increasingly one day, was not from one aha moment, and it was not developed in a year or two. It's been hard earned by putting ourselves in the shoes of our customers, knowing what they wanted, organizing Amazonians to work together to invent better solutions, and investing a large amount of financial and people resources over 20 years, often well in advance of when it would pay out. I think patience and perseverance and grit and going through building something that may not show you results of all that hard work for sometimes years and maybe even a decade. This type of iterative innovation is never finished and has periodic peaks in investment years, but leads to better long-term customer experiences, customer loyalty, and returns for our shareholders. Next, so that's about the fulfillment network innovations. Next one is around Amazon Web Services. As we were defining AWS and working backwards on the service, on the services we thought customers wanted, we kept triggering one of the biggest tensions in product development: where to draw the line on functionality in V1. Some people like to call this as the minimum viable product, MVP, V1, whatever it is, the first version. Where do you draw the line? Like, you can spend years building everything into V1 and then launch, or you could build something very minimal and then launch and iterate. One early meeting in particular for our core compute service called Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2, was scheduled for an hour, and it took 3 hours as we animatedly debated whether we could launch a compute service without an accompanying persistent block storage companion, a form of network-attached storage. This is interesting to note. Like, it was taken very seriously. I think that is what this is. Like, when you talk about a V1, you bring in all the leaders and the people involved, and you just lock yourself up in a room and really have animated debates for hours on to build the right thing in V1, right? Obviously, this is not happening just within the four walls of the office. It starts out by understanding the customer and the customer experiences, and then working backwards, you say, okay, these are all the amazing things that customers want and need, but what should be in V1? I think that is the debate here, and that should be taken seriously, and it should. I think the challenge teams have, and I've been through this, and in fact, I am going through this right now, where you're trying to launch a new AI product, for example, and you don't have all the answers to how AI could benefit your customers. The field is changing rapidly, and you have this dilemma where should I build a lot of value into the V1 and launch it then in 6 months, or should I launch something in 2 months and iterate because the models are improving, the token costs are coming down, a lot of exciting research is happening, and 6 months is a long time in AI. So in this particular case, I've tended to lean towards launching early and launching often and updating and iterating based on evaluating customer feedback. But in the case of AWS, let's see what Amazon's approach was. Everybody agreed that having a persistent block store was important to complete compute service. However, to have one ready would take an extra year. The question became, could we offer customers a useful service where they could get meaningful value before we had all the features we thought they wanted? We decided that the initial launch of EC2 could be feature poor if we also organized ourselves to listen to customers and iterate quickly. This, I think, has to be underlined. Like any new product, I personally truly believe 0-1 products, the strength is not imagining all the things you can build and building it. The strength is in building something of value and releasing it and really, really paying attention to what the customers are saying. And that part is very tricky because you need to really act on the customer feedback. You need to gather it, you need to analyze it, and you need to synthesize that feedback and act on it and make it actionable on the roadmap. And that becomes very challenging when you have early access feedback to these functionality in different channels. How do you collate it? How do you really get to the signal versus the noise? And those are the challenging things as a product builder. But it doesn't still preclude the fact that you have to launch quickly, iterate. I think that is, to me, the right approach to launching 0-1 products. The speed of iteration is really what matters, I think, at least big time. There may be other factors too. This approach works well if you indeed iterate quickly, but it is disastrous if you can't. I totally agree with that. I've launched products where we were iterating every 3 months or sometimes 6 months. In that kind of cycle time is just not going to cut it. You have to launch and iterate almost like in a daily or weekly basis and keep a very close tab on the customer feedback. We launched EC2 in 2006. Again, going back to Jeff's letter here. We launched EC2 in 2006 with one instance size in one data center in one region of the world with Linux operating system instances only, no Windows, without monitoring load balancing, auto-scaling, or yes, even persistent storage. EC2 was an initial success, but nowhere near the multi-billion-dollar service it's become until we added the missing capabilities listed above, and then some. So I think eventually they had to add S3, this a simple storage service, and they had to add CloudWatch and monitoring, and all of these amazing products that they've launched in Amazon Web Services portfolio. But if you thought about launching all of them on day one in V1, I mean, you'd not have AWS. That's, I think in my opinion, that's pretty clear. Like you need to have to focus on one thing and do it really well and then launch the next thing and do it really well and keep adding. And as a whole, I think the value becomes much more than the sum of its parts. In the early days of Amazon Web Services, people sometimes asked us why compute wouldn't just be an undifferentiated commodity. But there is a lot more to compute than just a server. Customers want various flavors of compute. Example, server configurations optimized for storage, memory, high-performance compute, graphics rendering, machine learning, and so on. Multiple form factors is another thing. Examples like fixed instance sizes versus portable containers, serverless functions, and so on. Various sizes and optimizations of persistent storage, and a slew of networking capabilities. Then there is the CPU chip that runs in your compute. For many years, the industry had used Intel or AMD x86 processors. We have important partnerships with these companies, but realized that if we wanted to push price and performance further, as customers had requested for, we would have to develop our own chips too. Our first generalized chip was Graviton, which we announced in 2018. This helped a subset of customers' workloads to run more effectively, more cost-effectively than prior options. But it was not until 2020, after taking the learnings from Graviton and innovating on a new chip, that we had something remarkable with our Graviton 2 chip, which provides up to 40% better price to performance than the comparable latest generation x86 processors. Think about how much of an impact 40% improvement on compute is. Compute is used for every bit of technology. That's a huge deal for customers. And while Graviton 2 has been a significant success thus far, 48 of the top 50 Amazon Web Service customers, EC2 customers, have already adopted it. The AWS chips team was already learning from what customers said could be better and announced Graviton 3 this past December, offering a 25% improvement on top of Graviton 2's relative gains. The list of what we have invented and delivered for customers in EC2 and in AWS in general is pretty mind-boggling. And this iterative approach to innovation has not only given customers much more functionality in AWS than they can find anywhere else, which is a significant differentiator, but also allowed us to arrive at much more game-changing offering that AWS is today. The next bit of like investments that they've done is around devices. Our first foray into devices was the Kindle, released in 2007. It was not the most sophisticated industrial design. It was creamy white in color, and the corners were uncomfortable for some people to hold, but revolutionary because it offered customers the ability to download any number of over 90,000 books, now actually a million books, in 60 seconds. And we got better and faster at building attractive designs. Shortly thereafter, we launched a tablet and then a phone, with the distinguishing feature of having front-facing cameras and a gyroscope to give customers a dynamic perspective along with varied 3D experiences. The phone was unsuccessful, and though we determined we were probably too late to this party and directed these resources elsewhere, we hired some fantastic long-term builders and learned valuable lessons from this failure that has served us well in devices like Amazon Echo and Fire TV. When I think of the first Echo device, again, this is Jeff talking, and what Alexa could do for customers at that point, it was noteworthy, yet so much less capable than what is possible today. Today, there are hundreds of millions of Alexa-enabled devices out there in homes, offices, cars, hotel rooms, Amazon Echo devices, and third-party manufacturer devices as well. You can listen to music or watch videos now. You can control your lights and home automation. You can create routines like start my day, where Alexa tells you the weather, your estimated commute time based on current traffic, then plays the news. You can easily order retail items on Amazon. You can get general or customized news, updates on sporting events and related stats. And we're still quite early with respect to what Alexa and Alexa-related devices will do for customers. Our goal is for Alexa to be the world's most helpful and resourceful personal assistant who makes people's lives meaningfully easier and better. I mean, in some ways, Alexa was the OG of agents, if you will. Alexa was one of the first agents that was trying to help you and was trying to schedule things for you, trying to create a list of groceries that you need to buy. It was reminding of your traffic and news and weather. I mean, it was a personal assistant. And it is, but it did not take off, in my opinion, as much as I would have liked it to be. I've been using Alexa for the last 7-8 years at least, and it does get a few things right, but a lot of things wrong in terms of user experiences and the kind of value it provides. It's still not really truly integrated into your day-to-day life, as you would consider, for example, an iPhone to be, right? You can't live without an smartphone, but you can certainly live without Alexa. And that is what I'm trying to say here. I mean, to truly become an insanely great product, which I have set a very high bar for those, like iPhone is an example of that. Amazon.com, obviously, is an example of that. But I think Alexa and devices have some ways to go. We have several other devices, again, coming back to Jeff's letter here. We have several other devices that at varying stages of evolution, example Ring and Blink, provide the leading digital home security solutions. Astro is a brand new home robot that we just launched in late 2021. But it's safe to say that every one of our devices, whether you're talking about Kindle, Fire TV, Alexa, Echo, Ring, Blink, or Astro, is an invention in process, with a lot more coming that will keep improving customers' lives. Another invention or investment, sorry, they made was around Prime Video. We started in 2006 with an offering called Amazon Unbox, where customers could download about 1,000 movies from major studios. This made sense as bandwidth was slower those days. It would take an hour to download a video. But as bandwidth got much faster to people's homes and mobile devices, along with advent of connected TVs, streaming was going to be a much better customer solution. And we focused our efforts on streaming. In 2011, we started offering over 5,000 streaming movies and shows as part of customers' Amazon Prime subscriptions. Initially, all of our content was produced by other studios and entertainment companies. These deals were expensive, country-specific, and only available to us for a limited period. So, to expand our options, we started creating our own original shows. Our early efforts included short-lived shows like Alpha House and Betas. Before we had our first award-winning series in Transparent, and eventually created multi-year franchises in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, The Boys, Bosch, and Jack Ryan. Along the way, we've learned a lot about producing compelling entertainment with memorable moments and using machine learning and other inventive technology to provide a superior quality streaming experience. With useful, relevant data about actors, TV shows, movies, music, or sports stats as a click away in our unique X-ray feature. This is a feature on Amazon Prime Video where you can press a button on the remote and it shows you the people in the movie, their bio data, like biographies, some more details around the cast and the director and the movie and all that. A lot of that coming from IMDb.com that they had acquired as well. You might have seen some of this in action in our recent new hit series, Reacher, and you will hopefully see it in our upcoming Lord of the Rings series launch coming Labor Day 2022. We also expect that you will see this iterative invention when we launch Thursday Night Football, the NFL's first weekly, primetime, streaming-only broadcast, airing exclusively on Prime Video starting in September 2022. Our agreement with the NFL is for 11 years, and we will work relentlessly over the next several years to reinvent NFL viewing experience for football fans. Shifting gears a little bit, Jeff talks about how their approach to things, right? We don't seek to be average. We want to be the best in class. We won't be satisfied until we do. If this approach sounds appealing, a natural question is, what is required to get good at it? I think this is something we can all pay attention to as product builders and product leaders in our own companies or as founders. How do you be best in class, and how do you, you know, strive to achieve that and not be satisfied until you do? Number one, Jeff provides us some hints at what has worked for them. Number one, hire the right builders. We disproportionately index in hiring builders. We think of builders as people who like to invent, who look at customer experiences, dissect what doesn't work well about them, and seek to reinvent them. We want people who keep asking, why can't it be done? I think it's a simple but very important question, right? Why can't it be done? We want people who like to experiment and tinker, and who realize launch is just the starting line, not the finish line. Number two, organize builders into teams that are as separable and autonomous as possible. I think this kind of goes back to the primitives discussion we had before. It's hard for teams to be, or even the two pizza teams that we talked about in the Amazon.com episode number three. It's hard to sometimes be deep in what customers care about in multiple areas. It is also hard to spend enough time on the new initiatives when there is resource contention with the more mature businesses. The surer bet usually wins out. Single-threaded teams will know their customers' needs better and spend all their waking and working hours inventing for them, for the customers, and develop context and tempo to keep iterating quickly. Number three, give teams the right tools and permissions to move fast. I think this is extremely important. Like, you could have leaders pushing for innovation and inventions and moving fast and doing things, but if you don't let the tools that freedom and give them the right tools to achieve or execute on that promise of moving fast with processes and red tape and approvals and all kinds of other things that slow things down, then you're not going to be able to achieve that insanely great product. Forget even insanely great product. You won't even be able to achieve product market fit fast enough, and the window might pass you by. So speed is not preordained, Jeff says. It is a leadership choice. It has trade-offs, but you can't wake up one day and start moving fast. It requires having the right tools to experiment and build fast, a major part of why we started AWS. Allowing teams to make two-way door decisions themselves. This is a metaphor that some of you may be familiar with, which comes from Jeff Bezos, about one-way doors and two-way doors. So one-way doors are decisions that you make that are very, very hard to change. Once you make the decision to go back on those, it's very hard. But two-way door decisions are, you can always come back through the same door if you don't like the choice or the decision. With some impact, but not a lot. And so allowing teams to make two-way door decisions themselves and setting an expectation that speed matters is very important. And it does. Speed is disproportionately important to every business at every stage of its evolution. Those that move slower than their competitive peers fall away over time. Number four, you need blind faith, but no false hope. This is a lyric from one of my favorite Foo Fighters songs, Congregation. When you invent, you come up with new ideas that people will reject because they have not been done before. That's where the blind faith comes in. But it's also important to step back and make sure you have a viable plan that will resonate with customers. Avoid false hope. We are lucky that we have builders who challenge each other. Feedback loops that give us access to customer feedback. And a product development process of working backwards from the customer, where having to write a press release to flesh out the customer benefits, and a frequently asked questions section in the document to detail how we would build it, help us have blind faith without false hope, at least usually. That is a very interesting nuance. Like, you need to have the blind faith, you need to be optimistic, but at the same time, make sure that you're building, working backwards from the customer experience, and you're also not setting false hope. Next one, number five, is define a minimum lovable product, not minimum viable product, but a minimum lovable product is how Amazon thinks about it, or Jeff Bezos thinks about it, and be willing to iterate fast. Figuring out where to draw the line for launch is one of the most difficult decisions teams must make. We talked about the V1 earlier today. Often teams wait too long and insist on too many bells and whistles before launching. I think this is very, I've seen this in very engineering-centric teams where customer is not really at the table. A lot of the times engineering leaders are saying, we need to do X, we need to do Y, this is a new technology, this is being adapted by somebody else, and why are we not adopting, and things like that. And then you get into this thing where you're building all kinds of bells and whistles, and the core product is almost missing out. And even if you have a core functionality, you're building all these things and wasting energy and effort that you're not serving the customer. Let's be honest, like, serving the customer is not about bells and whistles. It's about providing true value and addressing the customer problems head on. So it's very important to just focus and keep the focus on the core product. And then they miss the first mover advantage or opportunity to build mind share in fast moving market segments before well executing peers get too far ahead. The launch product must be good enough that you believe it'll be loved from the get-go. Why we call it a minimum lovable product versus a minimum viable product. But in new market segments, teams are often better off getting this MLP to customers and iterating quickly thereafter. Number six, adopt a long-term orientation. We are sometimes criticized at Amazon for not shutting much down. It is true that we have a longer tolerance for our investments than most companies. I mean, seriously, like, anyone else building Amazon.com in mid-90s would have probably shut the business down by late 90s or at the latest in the early 2000s when everything was bust, the dot-com bubble burst, and pretty much all dot-coms died. That's just one example of, you know, really, really thinking long-term, having the tolerance, believing in your vision, and just keep plowing through. But we know that transformational invention takes multiple years. Again, going back to Jeff's letter here, and if you're making big bets that you believe could substantially change customer experience and your company, you have to be in it for the long haul, or you'll go up too quickly. Excuse me. Number seven, brace yourself for failure. If you invent a lot, you will fail more often than you wish. Nobody likes this part. but it comes with the territory. When it is clear that we have launched something that won't work, we make sure we have learned from what didn't go well and secure great landing places for team members who delivered well, or your best people will hesitate to work on new initiatives. Albert Einstein is sometimes credited with describing compound interest as the eighth wonder of the world. He who understands it earns it. He who doesn't pays it. It's a quote. We think of iterative innovation in much the same way. Iterative innovation creates magic for customers. Constantly inventing and improving products for customers has a compounding effect on the customer experience and in turn on a business's prospects. Time is your friend when you're compounding gains. Compounding interest, as most of us are familiar with, and Charlie Munger talks about this a lot, it's kind of like an exponential curve. It's not a linear curve. So the more you play the game, whether it's investing or building products or building companies, the better off you'll be, especially in the later stages of the company or the product's life. So time is your friend when you're compounding gains. Amazon is a big company with some large businesses, but it is still early days for us. We will continue to be insurgent, inventing in businesses that we are in new businesses that we've yet to launch, and in new ideas that we have not even imagined yet. It remains day one. Shareholder Letter 2020. Last year, we hired 500,000 employees and now directly employ 1.3 million people around the world. We have more than 200 million Prime members worldwide, more than 1.9 million small and medium-sized businesses selling in our store, and they make up close to 60% of our retail sales. Customers have connected more than 100 million smart home devices to Alexa. Amazon Web Services serves millions of customers and ended 2020 with a $50 billion annualized run rate. In 1997, we had not invented Prime, Marketplace, Alexa, or AWS. They were not even ideas then, and none was preordained. On the details, we at Amazon are always flexible, but on matters of vision, we are stubborn and relentless. I think this is very, very important, right? I think it's so hard to stick to your guns when things are not working your way. But sticking to the vision that you wanted to achieve and realize in this world is very important. And be stubborn about it and be relentless in pursuing that. But on the details of how we achieve the vision, sometimes you might have to pivot, you have to change things. That is the whole meaning of pivot, right? You're actually laying a stake in the ground and then pivoting, using that as the anchor point. If you're completely shifting, lifting and shifting to something else, that's not pivot, that is something else. It's a new business you're trying to start, completely new, different business. So being stubborn, I've learned that in my own adventures, that I've given up a little too soon. I was not relentless in my startup that was building iPad and iPhone applications for children. I think it's important, now I learned that lesson, to first of all have a vision and a perspective and truly believe in it, and then just stick to it and pivot how many ever times you have to make that vision come true. Differentiation is survival, and the universe wants you to be typical. This is a philosophical note in this letter from Bezos. I think it's important. I liked it a lot. On the mindset and the approach, it's not all just about products and features and numbers and growth rates. and compounding interest and things like that. It is also about the mindset and the approach of how you live your life and how you build your products. So let me read you this segment of the letter. This is my last annual shareholder letter as the CEO of Amazon. And I have one last thing of utmost importance I feel compelled to teach. I hope all Amazonians take it to heart. Here is a passage from Richard Dawkins from this extraordinary book, The Blind Watchmaker. It is about a basic fact of biology. Quoting from the book, staving off death is a thing that you have to work at. Left to itself, and that is what it is when it dies, the body tends to revert to a state of equilibrium with its environment. It's also similar to, digressing for a second, but it is similar to the weeds in the lawn. Like if you don't tend to the lawn, the weeds quickly take over and you're trying to regress to the mean. I think similar to that here, like the human body tends to revert to a state of equilibrium with its nature, which is always degrading, right? Unless you work out and eat properly and do all these things, the body is not going to just stay healthy and fit, right? So going back to the quote from the book, if you measure some quantity such as the temperature, the acidity, the water content, or the electrical potential in a living body, you will typically find that it is markedly different from the corresponding measure in the surroundings. Our bodies, for instance, are usually hotter than our surroundings. And in cold climates, they have to work hard to maintain the differential. When we die, the work stops. The temperature differential starts to disappear, and we end up the same temperature as our surroundings. Not all animals work so hard to avoid coming into equilibrium with their surrounding temperature. But all animals do some comparable work. For instance, in a dry country, animals and plants work to maintain the fluid content of their cells, work against a natural tendency for water to flow from them into the dry outside world. If they fail, they die. More generally, if living things didn't work actively to prevent it, they would eventually merge into their surroundings and cease to exist as autonomous beings. That is what happens when they die. So Jeff's note on this passage from the book, The Blind Watchmaker. While the passage is not intended as a metaphor, it is nevertheless a fantastic one and very relevant to Amazon. I would argue that it's relevant to all companies and all institutions and to each of our individual lives too. In what ways does the world pull at you in an attempt to make you normal? How much work does it take to maintain your distinctiveness, to keep alive the thing or the things that make you special? Shareholder letter from 2018. Amazon's 3P business, third-party business, grew from a meager 3% of gross merchandise sales in 1999 to a staggering 58% of sales by 2018. First party sales went from 1.6 billion in 1999 to $117 billion, compounding at 25%. But at the same time, third party sales went from 0.1 billion to 160 billion at a compounded annual growth rate of 52%. That's more than double of the first party sales. Why did independent sellers do better than Amazon's own first party sales or even that of eBay? There isn't one answer by how we know, but we do know extremely important part of the answer is that we helped independent sellers compete against our first party business by investing in and offering them the very best selling tools we could imagine and build. I think this is my note here is like, this is very counterintuitive, right? Like, nobody thought this was going to work. Like, why would you bring someone else that is competing to sell the same products and ask them to sell in your store alongside your other products? Right? That sounds pretty counterintuitive, crazy. This is a counterintuitive, contrarian idea that paid off big time, right? And more importantly, though, Amazon, I think the way I see it, Amazon's customer obsession extends beyond just consumers, but also to sellers, right? They built the best possible tools that the sellers could use. Sellers were treated equals along with Amazon's own internal category managers and sellers. Many tools were created to help sellers, including tools that help sellers manage inventory, process payments, track shipments, create reports, and sell across borders. We are inventing more. But of great importance are fulfillment by Amazon FBA and Amazon Prime membership programs. In combination, these two programs meaningfully improved customer experience of buying from independent sellers. Imagine this could have gone completely sideways, actually, right? I mean, think about it. Actually, if it did, when Amazon launched, for example, Z Shops as third-party marketplace, where sellers were not necessarily first-rate citizens on Amazon.com. Z-Shops, I mean, there were learnings from it, but eventually they shut that down because it's not building the right tools and not treating the sellers as equal to rest of the sellers within Amazon. There was a significant financial risk investing in fulfillment by Amazon and Amazon Prime membership. Because they were losing money on these things. We could not foresee what those programs would eventually look like, let alone whether they would succeed. But they were pushed forward and with intuition and heart, and nourished them with optimism. No one in their right mind would have moved forward on these programs. You cannot come to such crucial decision by applying logic and data, because there was no data. And logically, this is a money-losing proposition. Why would your spreadsheet calculations supporting going forward with this insane contrarian idea that turned out to be the right idea? It boils down to customer obsession. If you have the conviction, right, that customers will be delighted with these programs, FBA and Prime, because they have more selection, third-party seller products, get shipped through FBA, very similar to Amazon's own first-party products and so on. So the customer really doesn't know. If you ask a customer whether they bought a product today from a third party or from Amazon, they would most, like 9 out of 10 probably would not know the difference, because most of the sellers have adopted FBA. And so customers' experience is very much seamless across the board. If you have the conviction that customers will be delighted and will return to the store to make more purchases, increase their average order size because of free shipping and reliable and consistent deliveries promised, whether it's first party or third party product, then you have set a flywheel in motion that cannot be stopped, right? That's my notes on how these were very risky bets, but I think customer obsession working backwards from customer delight and experience, I think makes a huge difference in how you think about these kind of new 0-to-1 products that sound very risky at the face value. Bezos on intuition. Curiosity and the power of wandering. Yes, I think I'm reminded of this nice quote. Not all those who are lost wandering are lost, actually. Or something like that. Like, yeah, wandering is a very important aspect of innovating and following your curiosity and the power of wandering. From the very early on in Amazon's life, we knew we wanted to create a culture of builders, people who are curious explorers. They like to invent. Even when they are experts, they are fresh with a beginner's mind. A builder's mentality helps us approach big, hard to solve problems or opportunities, with a humble conviction that success can come through iteration. Invent, launch, reinvent, relaunch, start over, rinse, repeat again and again. They know that the path to success is anything but straight. Sometimes, often usually in business, you do know where you're going. And when you do, you can be efficient. Put in place a plan and then execute on it. In contrast to that, wandering in business is not efficient, but it's also not random. And it is important, as we just heard from Jeff. Like, to truly innovate, I think you have to do some wandering. In contrast, wandering in business is not efficient, but it's also not random. It is guided by hunch, gut, intuition, curiosity, and powered by deep conviction that the price for customers is big enough that it's worth being a little messy and tangential to find our way there. Wandering is an essential counterbalance to efficiency. You need to employ both. The outsized discoveries, the non-linear asymmetric ones, are highly likely to require wandering. This paragraph is super important. How you build products working backwards from customers, right? Much of what we build at AWS is based on listening to customers. It is critical to ask customers what they want, listen carefully to their answers, and figure out a plan to provide it thoughtfully and quickly. Speed matters in business. No business could thrive without that kind of customer obsession. But it's also not enough. The biggest needle movers will be things that customers don't know to ask for. We must invent on their behalf. We have to tap into our own inner imagination about what is possible. AWS itself, as a whole, is an example. No one asked for AWS. No one. Turns out that world was in fact ready and hungry for an offering like AWS, Amazon Web Services, but did not know about it. We had a hunch, followed our curiosity, took the necessary financial risks, and began building, reworking, experimenting, iterating countless number of times as we proceeded. To all of you, be kind. Again, just this, some of the last words from Jeff Bezos in his shareholders' letters from 2018. To all of you, be kind, be original, create more than you consume, and never, never, never let the universe smooth you into your surroundings. It remains day one. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, please share with your friends, subscribe, and I will leave you with the day one mindset. I think one of the town hall meetings, Jeff talks about this. An employee asked him, "So Jeff, you keep talking about day one. When is the day two going to come?" And he says, "Never. If we're lucky, never, because day two basically means stasis. It's day two is the start of dying." And so they want to keep that day one mindset, day one culture, my mentality, scrappiness, thinking big, innovating on customers' behalf, and speed, and really working hard and being very stubborn about your vision, and a lot of these amazing qualities that Amazon has distilled into those 14 or so leadership principles. I think it's worth checking out, and they help you sort of keep that day one mindset. With that, I'll leave you. Adios, and we'll see you in next episode. Bye.